Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1209, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and the ongoing Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank. During the second segment, I will air a podcast from Middle East Eye titled Greater Israel, Is Lebanon the First Destination? In that podcast, Matilda Melinson, host of the podcast, interviews Dr. Maha Shaib, director of the Center for Lebanese Studies, about the forced displacement of over 1 million Lebanese by Israel, and also interviews Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist and author, about the Israeli attack and its plans for Lebanon. During the second segment, I will air an opinion by Sumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert on Middle East politics, titled By Serving Israel's Agenda, Trump Betrayed Gulf Allies. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 895 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. At least 12 Palestinians were killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza on Sunday, March 15th, including two boys, a pregnant woman, and a group of police officers. An Israeli strike on one of the last still-standing houses in the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza killed four people, including a man, his wife, who was pregnant with twins, and their 10-year-old son. A 15-year-old child in a neighboring shelter was killed in the strike. Another neighbor told the Associated Press that, quote, "We were sleeping and got up to the strike of a missile. The strike was strong. There was no prior warning." Later in the day, an Israeli missile struck a police car in the nearby town of Zueida, killing eight police officers. At least 14 others were wounded in the attack. Reporter Mustafa Musallam captured video in the aftermath of the strike, with crowds gathered around several bodies laying on the street next to the wreckage of the vehicle. On Tuesday, March 17th, an Israeli drone strike killed three Palestinians, including a 14-year-old child, Tamer Baraka, in the Mawasi area of Khan Yunis. As of Wednesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that since the fraudulent ceasefire was agreed upon in October 2025, 677 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,800 have been injured. A brutal sandstorm hit the Gaza Strip this past week, battering fragile tents and makeshift shelters. Reporter Mohammed Abu Salama captured footage of people bearing against the winds and sand, which turned the air bright orange. The lack of adequate shelter and infrastructure to protect people under such conditions remains a product of a deliberate Israeli policy, as Israel has sealed shut all but one of the crossings in and out of Gaza since the attacks on Iran began 3 weeks ago on February 28th. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated this week that the sandstorm destroyed or damaged the shelters of more than 600 families. People continue to have difficulty accessing food due to interruptions to the entry of supplies and shortages of cooking gas, the UN added. The World Food Program and other UN partners leading on food security warned that more than half of families in Gaza are burning trash to cook food. Despite efforts to reopen facilities, the UN office stated, quote, "Only two out of every five health service points are currently operating, most of them only partially." On March 15th, the World Health Organization collected nearly 50 intensive care unit beds that it had offloaded at the Kerem Shalom or Kerem Abu Salem crossing. The collection was delayed due to the Israeli authorities' suspension of humanitarian movements to Kerem Shalom last week. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated that, quote, since the reopening of Kerem Shalom, Israeli authorities have allowed only a few dozen trucks to enter Gaza through the end of last week, still falling short by about 30 trucks per day compared to the daily average permitted before the war with Iran. Included in the violations of the so-called ceasefire agreement are ongoing refusals by Israel of the stipulated amount of fuel entering Gaza. Only 14.8% of the agreed quantity of fuel is allowed to enter, Euromed states, quote, resulting in the severe disruption of vital sectors, including hospitals, water and sanitation networks, relief services, and transportation. Moreover, Israel continues to use starvation as a weapon in its ongoing genocide against civilians in the Gaza Strip, the rights group says. Quote, this policy depletes essential means of survival and forcibly drives displacement by tightly controlling the quantity and type of food and goods allowed into the enclave, as well as restricting humanitarian and commercial supplies, worsening the humanitarian crisis and risking renewed widespread famine. Israel is exploiting the international community's focus on the war it and the United States have launched on Iran to tighten the siege on the Gaza Strip and continue using starvation in a manner that deepens the humanitarian catastrophe and reinforces the destructive impact of the ongoing genocide against civilians, Euromed asserted. On Wednesday, the Gaza Government Media Office stated that since the October 10th ceasefire, Israel has committed at least 2,073 military violations of the agreement, documented by Gaza authorities. Such violations include 750 incidents of gunfire, 87 incidents of military vehicle incursions into residential neighborhoods and areas, 973 incidents of shelling and targeting, and 263 incidents involving the demolition of homes and various buildings. Only 40% of the humanitarian aid trucks have entered, along with the fraction of fuel trucks. Additionally, the government media office stated that Israel has failed to adhere to the withdrawal lines inside Gaza. It has refused entry to infrastructure, repair materials, and heavy machinery for the civil defense teams to clear rubble and recover bodies. It has prevented the entry of medicine and medical equipment, and it has failed to allow the entry of tents, mobile homes, and shelter materials. Reporter Mahmoud Hamda captured that video showing the current scale of destruction in Gaza. Meanwhile, buried in an article published by the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz disparaging the Hamas political party's assertion of governance in Gaza amid 2.5 years of Israel's genocide, it was revealed that amidst a continuing crisis of food insecurity, thousands of food parcels remain on the Israeli side of the Kerem Abu Salem or Kerem Shalom crossing and are being looted by Israelis. Haaretz reported that the parcels were left at the former Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's logistics compound at the crossing, which include dozens of tons of dry food and staples such as sugar, salt, and legumes. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israel is conducting what the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights calls mass expulsions of Palestinians, with the forcible displacement of more than 36,000 people over the last year as illegal settlement colonies expand and the political push to formally annex the West Bank is accelerating. Since the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran began, the situation has become worse, the commissioner's office stated in a report this week. Quote, Israeli security forces have continued to kill Palestinians with impunity, the UN says. Israeli security forces have launched daily raids across the West Bank, seized dozens of Palestinian homes for several hours or several days to use as interrogation centers, and detained at least 200 Palestinians, including for social media posts labeled as incitement or glorification of the enemy, the UN stated. Israeli authorities have tightened the already heavy discriminatory closures and movement restrictions across the West Bank, tearing communities apart and impeding Palestinians' access to healthcare, livelihoods, education, and basic services. Settler violence, which the report states is up 24% from the same time period last year, continues, quote, in a coordinated, strategic, and largely unchallenged manner, with Israeli authorities playing the central role in directing, participating in, or enabling this conduct. Israeli settlers are roaming free with complete impunity, often armed, forcing Palestinian family after Palestinian family off their lands. As a result, at least 9 Palestinian communities have been fully or partially displaced since February 28th, mostly in the northern Jordan Valley, the UN added. Settlers attacked several Palestinian villages this week, including in Hirbet Homsa on March 13th, where settlers handcuffed and beat 14 residents, according to the group Breaking the Silence. This attack came a day after settlers invaded the village at night and forced residents and International Protective Presence activists into a tent, where they were tied up and abused for about an hour. According to photojournalist Oren Ziv, writing in 972 magazine, quote, around 10 adults and 7 children were held inside the tent, according to witnesses. The attackers beat them with clubs, poured cold water on them, threatened them, and sexually assaulted one of the residents. 4 Palestinians and 2 international activists were later taken to a hospital in the nearby city of Tubas. According to 4 witnesses who spoke to 972, all of whom asked to remain anonymous for fear of reprisal, the attack began late at night and involved dozens of settlers. One witness, who is about 40 years old, said a large group arrived at the first house in the village around 1 a.m. I tried to run away, but they caught me, beat me, cut my hand with a knife, and tied my hands and feet with plastic zip ties, he told 972, showing the marks left on his arms and legs. They were all masked except for one. We recognized him. The attackers, armed with clubs and knives, forced the residents into a tent in the center of the community. They gathered us in one room, men, women, and small children, the witness said. No one was left outside. They threw us onto the concrete floor on top of one another. They tied the women too and kept beating us. According to the witness, some of the attackers spoke Arabic. They said, today we'll take your sheep, but next time we come, we'll burn the houses, kill the children, and rape the women. That's from Oren Ziv's report in 972 magazine. In a televised interview for CNN on Wednesday, 29-year-old Kusai Abu al-Kabash said the settlers bound him by his hands and legs and stripped him. Quote, they cut my belt off with a knife, as well as my boxers. They zip-tied my penis, tightened it, and then dragged me all around the village. It was very, very painful. I thought they were going to kill me, he said. I'm worried they'll come back, that they'll kill us in the middle of the night or burn our village like they said they would, he added. Also on March 13th, a pogrom was enacted against Palestinians in the village of Kusra. Masked settlers roamed between houses with weapons for hours before they attacked a home, smashed windows, and shot dead a man, Amir Mutasim, and wounded 3 others, according to Matan Golan, a photojournalist with the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz. On March 14th, Israeli soldiers killed a couple and their 2 sons while they were driving in their car in the village of Tamun in the north. Ali Bani Oda, his wife Waad, and their sons Mohammed, 5 years old, and Othman, 7, were shot in the heads and upper bodies by undercover Israeli forces on their way back from a Ramadan shopping trip. Ali and Waad's 2 other children, 11-year-old Khaled and 8-year-old Mustafa, were wounded with shrapnel from the shootings while trying to protect their youngest brother, according to Mondo Weiss's Qassam Wadi. According to the Israeli border police, the special forces had been in Tamun to arrest wanted Palestinians when they came across the Bani Oda family's car, which allegedly, quote, accelerated towards the forces, which felt endangered and opened fire. The raiding Israeli force had entered the town earlier in the day undetected, Tamun's mayor Samir Bisharat told Mondo Weiss, since the soldiers were undercover. Those are excerpts from Qassam Wadi's report in Mondo Weiss. Detailed analysis of the attack was reported by Defense for Children International Palestine, which said that Israelis continued to shoot the car for about 3 minutes, quote, after which the family's 2 older sons, 11-year-old Khaled and 8-year-old Mustafa, got out of the car and cried out for help. Israeli forces arrived on scene shortly after, physically assaulting the 2 boys and preventing paramedics from reaching the wounded family members still inside the car. After about 30 minutes, Israeli forces finally permitted paramedics to reach the family, and all 6 of them were transported to the Turkish governmental hospital in Tubas. Othman and Mohammed, along with their parents, were pronounced dead on arrival. Othman was shot in the face and also sustained shrapnel injuries to the head, neck, shoulders, and chest. Mohammed suffered shrapnel injuries to the face, head, left eye, neck, chest, and shoulders, according to the medical report issued by the hospital and by Palestine Red Crescent Society medical teams. Speaking to reporters, Khaled, the 11-year-old, said he had heard his mother crying and his father praying before they died. After the gunfire stopped, Israeli border police dragged him out of the wreckage, taunted him about the murders of his family, and attacked him. One of the Israelis said, "We killed dogs," he told Reuters. In a video, Khaled recounted what he said to the Israeli soldiers when he was being dragged outside by the soldiers. "Do you love your father and mother?" he said he asked an Israeli soldier, who replied, "Yes." "Then why did you kill my father and mother?" he asked. Quote, "Then he punched me in the face," Khaled says.
أنا سألت الجندي أنت بتحب أبوك وأمك؟ قالت لي نعم. قلت له طيب لا تقتل أبوي وأمي. قاعد كان ضربني بوكس أوجهي.
On March 16th, just 2 days after the Bani Oda family massacre, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 16-year-old child, Salim Fukaha, in the village of Sinjil, northeast of Ramallah. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Israeli forces opened fire on Salim and 15-year-old Fatih al-Sahouri, who survived the attack, then prevented Palestine Red Crescent Society paramedics from reaching the boys for 2.5 hours. Israeli forces confiscated Salim's body, and therefore DCIP cannot confirm the number or nature of his injuries, the rights group stated. Paramedics brought Fatih to a hospital in Ramallah, where he is currently receiving treatment for a gunshot wound to the shoulder. The shooting took place in an area near the barrier established by Israeli forces about 1.5 years ago on land belonging to the village of Sinjil, isolating it from Route 60, which has led to escalating tensions in the area. This area frequently witnesses live fire by Israeli forces toward anyone suspected of being present nearby, without distinction, making it a dangerous zone that constantly threatens civilians' lives. Israeli forces have killed 7 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2026, according to documentation collected by Defense for Children International Palestine. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight "Everything Feels Blurry" by Noor Khalil Khattab, writing from Gaza. In a tent pitched on uneven ground in Deir al-Balah, Layan Badouan, 9, sits on the floor with a notebook on her knees, Khattab writes. Quote, "The wind moves the tent's edges, and the sound of a surveillance drone in the sky is constant. Layan tries to write her full name. She stops at one letter, looks at me, then smiles shyly. I want to go back to my school. I miss the room where I used to study." Layan is originally from El Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. She had completed the first grade when school ended with the outbreak of war in October 2023. Since then, classrooms are no longer classrooms, and school years no longer feel like years. Israel's genocide in Gaza has brought the education sector to an almost complete halt, leaving thousands of children out of classrooms or in temporary learning spaces that lack the most basic resources. For many families, the question is no longer about the quality of education, but whether there is any at all. Over these 2.5 years, everything changed. Homes were destroyed. Schools were closed or turned into shelters for displaced families. Others were bombed, and displacement became an oft-repeated routine. I met Layan on January 23rd in a tent set up on her uncle's land in Deir al-Balah. She wore a pink hoodie, her favorite color, and held her notebook as if it were something precious. She told me she likes to study English so I can learn languages and know more about the world. But at an age when she should be reading fluently, Layan still struggles with words. She writes half a sentence and stops. She finds it difficult to read and write smoothly. Layan is not an exception. In my modest apartment in Deir al-Balah, I met Abdulrahman Al-Attar and Tamim Muammar, both 13. They sat side by side, speaking as if they had grown used to telling their story. Before the war, Abdulrahman would wake up before 6 a.m., he said, and walk half an hour to school. He memorized the morning school broadcast and recited the anthem. He loves Arabic, reads poetry, and dreams of becoming a police officer like his father. Tamim also attended regular school. He loves math and engineering and remembers the schoolyard where he played football with friends. He hopes to become a surgeon. Today they study in a shelter called Badr School. The classroom is made of corrugated metal sheets, and in winter, rain leaks through the roof. Desks are worn out and chairs are broken. We study, but the notebook isn't clear. Everything feels blurry. When it rains, we can't finish the lesson and we have to go home, Tamim said, pointing to their heads. Tamim said, "Sometimes I get dizzy and forget a lot. Before the war, it wasn't like this. My eyes tear up and I feel foggy." They stopped going to school when war started. Displacement, fear, and internet outages made learning difficult. When nearby shelling is heard, Abdulrahman sits on the ground and covers his head. Tamim moves closer to his mom and falls silent. UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, estimates that more than 90% of Gaza's schools require either full reconstruction or major rehabilitation to be functional again, and that most of Gaza's 658,000 school-aged children have had only limited face-to-face learning in 2 years. When I asked Leanne what she missed most, she did not say lessons or grades. "I miss my room. When I first saw our house after we were displaced and it had been bombed, I cried a lot. I had a box under my bed full of letters and stories. I love reading stories and exploring languages and cultures." For these children, education is no longer a system or a curriculum. It has become a memory of a place or a sound without drones. Those are excerpts from Everything Feels Blurry by Noor Khalil Khattab, a journalist and writer and translator writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine. Music teacher Ahmed Muin Abu Amsha visited with and accompanied a new girls' choir in Khan Yunis. He says that, quote, "beautiful young voices, full of positive energy and hope. This is just the beginning for them, and they really need support. Music is still alive in Gaza, and in Khan Yunis there is amazing energy. Wishing them all the success." The song they sing is called "Tiri Tiri Yasfura," or "Fly, Fly, Little Bird." And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The Israeli onslaught on Lebanon continues, causing death, destruction, and forced displacement of over 1 million Lebanese. Many are calling that the Gaza Doctrine. And as you know, apartheid Israel wreaked havoc in the Gaza Strip with its ongoing genocide, killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, destroyed the Gaza Strip, and there was no one there to stop it. So apartheid Israel knows that it can basically do whatever it wants to do anywhere to anyone. Kill, destroy, steal land, and much, much worse. And there would be no one to stop it. Acting with full impunity and complete support by the United States, some European countries, and others. On March 17, 2026, Matilda Melanson, host of the Middle East Eye Live podcast, interviewed Dr. Maha Shaib, director of the Center for Lebanese Studies, about the forced displacement of over 1 million Lebanese by Israel, and also interviewed Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist and author, about the Israeli attack on Lebanon. The podcast was titled Greater Israel, Is Lebanon the First Destination? Let's take a listen.
Hello and welcome to MEE Live. I'm Matilda Mallinson. It's Tuesday, the 17th of March, 2026. Today, why did Israel displace a million people in Lebanon? Out of the media spotlight, Lebanon is fast becoming the most violently uprooting front of the regional war, with one-fifth of the population now displaced. But listen to how mainstream media is describing it.
Israel has warned civilians in southern Lebanon to evacuate to the north of the Litani River, declaring that anyone remaining close to Hezbollah positions was endangering their life.
The Israeli military has ordered the evacuation of dozens of villages and towns in southern Lebanon, calling residents to move north of the Litani River.
The Israel Defense Forces issued their first evacuation order for downtown Beirut today ahead of airstrikes, along with a sweeping new evacuation order across southern Lebanon. About 10% of Lebanese territory is now under Israeli evacuation notices.
The IDF has issued an evacuation order for most of southern Beirut, warning thousands of people to flee. And it's already ordered evacuations for many villages in the southern parts of Lebanon. Israel has issued evacuation warnings for much of southern Beirut as it intensifies strikes in Lebanon. The IDF released footage of what it says was intelligence-based strikes on Hezbollah infrastructure.
Is this an evacuation or something more sinister? Nearly 1,000 people have been killed so far, entire neighbourhoods levelled to the ground, a million displaced, a territory cleared many times the size of Gaza, and all in the midst of a regional war that has the world's eyes watching elsewhere. Just because Israel calls it an evacuation, should the media blindly repeat them? At what point does it become forced displacement? For more than a million people in Lebanon now sleeping in cars, shelters, camps and the streets, the difference between words may feel immaterial, but under international law, the difference is monumental. Under the Geneva Convention, armies are obliged to give advance warning of attacks that may affect civilian populations, but they are strictly prohibited from forcibly displacing civilians, unless it is for their own security. Even in this case, they must ensure there is satisfactory shelter and allow civilians to return as soon as possible. In other words, an evacuation is a legal requirement, but forced displacement is a war crime. Dr. Maha Schweib is an executive on the International Association for the Study of Forced Migration. Dr. Maha, welcome to MEE Live. Western media is largely referring to what is happening in Lebanon as an evacuation. Is this the right word to use?
Thank you very much. Just to correct, I'm the director of the Center for Lebanese Studies. Well, I think the use of this language is consistent with the use of words such as conflict, crisis, etc., rather than occupation, war, invasion. So it's the same, kind of words that try to depoliticize what is happening. And an evacuation is like there's a fire alarm rather than an invasion and a war. And that has killed so far over 800 civilians in Lebanon and displaced over 1 million. So it's consistent with what, unfortunately, global media wants to use in terms of depoliticized language and to make us, we just die like this. You know, we're not killed and the perpetrator is missing subject.
Thank you. And you've talked about the scale of this displacement. Has Lebanon ever seen anything like this? I mean, there was heavy bombardment by Israel in 2024 and high levels of displacement. How does that compare to today?
So what we see today is a strategy that Israel has always adopted in Lebanon, I've lived most of my life in the south of Lebanon. In 1993, they've also displaced a similar number. 1996, the same. 2006, again, 2024 and 2026. It's the same strategy where Israel tries to empty the south of its population, but, as well as Dahiya area in Beirut and to put pressure on the Lebanese government, but also to pressure the population that they see to support Hezbollah and to push them to further alienation, but also to withdraw their support from Hezbollah. And we have tried the, you know, we've seen these scenarios happening over and over again. And yes, the devastation and the suffering of the Lebanese civilian population is unbearable, but rarely it achieves its objectives in terms of, you know, making people feel like it's a cause that they're willing to give up.
So are you saying that it isn't successfully reducing support for Hezbollah in Lebanon?
What you know, looking at how the response has been, while some people have found that it's it was quite, you know, not a successful strategy from Hezbollah to fire those six rockets in the beginning of the war. There's also the argument that Israel was going anyway to hit Hezbollah as soon as it's done with Iran. So what Iran and Hezbollah has done in this case is to come together and join the battle together instead of leaving each one alone. And there is also there was also after 2024 the feeling that Iran abandoned Hezbollah in the sense of leaving them to fight the battle alone and not to respond to the assassination of and the killing of Nasrallah. So I think this time they know they are both in it for you know, and Israel and the US is there to finish them off. So they've realized that there is a need to come together. And now in terms of the how do you know, what response you see? Obviously, there's a big divide in the Lebanese population. There are those who feel this was unnecessary, and there are those who realize that it was coming anyway. And even if they were not supportive of Hezbollah taking the first step, they could see now that it was about to come. Yet, undeniably, there's a big division within the Lebanese. And if you look at the response of the Lebanese government, for many people who come from the south of Lebanon and displaced, it's a quite a, you know, an unsupportive position from their government.
I suppose those divisions, as well as just being, you know, supportive or not supportive of Hezbollah, an element that's really being emphasized by Israel is the Shia element, and sort of conflating the Shia population or blaming the Shia population for the Israeli bombardment, sowing seeds of sectarianism. Is that having an impact? Is that seeing a flare up in sectarianism or discrimination within Lebanon?
I think there was certainly what is quite interesting this time is the emphasis and the how many times the word Shia was used in the media. Rather than the population of the south of Lebanon or Dahiya, I think there has been a conscious attempt to make divisions, to alienate the Shia population and to further cause this rupture. But I think there is also awareness amongst quite a few Lebanese across all different sects that this war is, you know, as long as Israel is, you know, is following this policy, these wars are going to happen regardless of what Hezbollah will do or not. But also they have seen over the past year, Hezbollah didn't fire one bullet towards Israel, but Israel has killed over 500 Lebanese people, despite giving the Lebanese government the green light to solve the issue with diplomacy. But what we've seen is that the agreement for the ceasefire was not respected. The state of Lebanon is unable to defend its people. And what we also saw is the Lebanese army withdrew on day one from its positions and kept withdrawing, which basically puts you as a citizen of Lebanon, well, if the army can't protect you, if diplomacy can't protect you, well, you don't have many options, regardless of whether you like Hezbollah politics or you don't, and whether you really want to change their the extent of or challenge their extent of power within the Lebanese government. There's the other issue of how do you deter Israel from invading the country? Because if Israel chooses to invade Lebanon at any moment, it can certainly do that. And there's nothing that would stop it.
Let's just talk about the scale of the humanitarian impact here. Dr. Maha, you're an expert in displacement. Lebanon already hosts the largest number of refugees in the world relative to its population. How global could the ripple effects of mass displacement of Lebanese residents be as a result of these attacks?
So far, if we look at most of the displacement has been internal this time. We because of the, obviously the fall of the Assad regime, many of the Shia population or the population in the south of Lebanon wouldn't go to Syria at the moment. Despite that, around 7,000 Lebanese did cross the borders. 76,000 Syrian refugees have also went back to Syria. Still, we have almost a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. So the suffering across all sectors, and we have had quite a few Syrian and Palestinian civilians who've been killed in Lebanon. So the impact has been devastating, you know, on all sectors and all populations. I think it will remain largely a local issue in terms of the displacement will remain primarily in Beirut, in some areas of Lebanon, Mount Lebanon. The numbers are increasing. Yesterday, they were 800,000 as we were following the numbers. This morning, it's 1 million. So the numbers are increasing significantly and very quickly.
As well as the scale numerically, geographically, there's also the question of the duration of this displacement. If this is an evacuation, as Israel says, then the law requires them to allow people to return home as soon as possible. Do Lebanese people who are currently being displaced feel that they will be able to return home? What do people in Lebanon think is going to happen? What do they fear could happen?
Obviously, the fear is that this will become a protracted and long-term conflict. From judging by the previous wars, we know usually, you know, a very long and protracted conflict may not, is not often the case. But last time, but we are seeing these wars have lasting longer and longer. The last one was over 2 months. I think as long as Hezbollah, we'll have to see how long it will stand the battle. Israel is now talking about an invasion, a full invasion, ground invasion of the south of Lebanon that expands beyond even the south of Laitani. So we'll have to see in terms of the battle what will happen in the war with Iran. Iran is insisting on any resolution or ceasefire has to encompass both countries. So how long will that, it will take to see this? And obviously, this will leave a huge pressure on the government of Lebanon and on the Lebanese. And this time, what you also see in terms of humanitarian response is the funding is much, much less. The resources are very constrained, particularly as today there was an article around by humanitarian agencies basically saying that these resources that they have has to be distributed across all the different countries that are affected by the war now. And most of the countries in the region now are affected by war. So the resources are limited. And to what extent the state of Lebanon is interested as well in elevating the pressure and providing responses. It knew that the war is coming, but yet again, we didn't have an emergency plan. We didn't build shelters, and every time we act as surprised.
Dr. Maha Shwaib, thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with us today. How long have Israeli settlers been waiting to settle Lebanon? In 1982, Israeli forces pushed far into Lebanese territory, killing over 10,000 and displacing generations. It was a war, Israel said, of self-defense, faced with cross-border rockets and raids by the PLO, a Palestinian militia founded four decades earlier in response to Israel's occupation and forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Four decades later, Israel has launched a ground offensive in southern Lebanon once again. Five military divisions have been dispatched to the border, supported by air and artillery strikes that have already displaced a million people. Again, Israel says it is self-defense, faced with cross-border rockets and raids by Hezbollah, a Lebanese militia founded four decades earlier in response to Israel's occupation and the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Lebanese. So, four decades ago, Israel invaded to fight a resistance group it had radicalized four decades earlier, leading to the birth of a new resistance group which is invading now to fight four decades later. Is history repeating itself in Lebanon? Hezbollah has repeatedly attacked Israeli forces since joining the war on the 2nd of March, but invading Lebanon has not historically proven an effective security strategy for Israel. So is this really about self-defense? This is one of over 300 properties in southern Lebanon listed on an Israeli settler website when the Israeli army launched its 2024 bombing campaign. It says, "After the elimination of the Hezbollah leadership, do you also dream of a big house, a view of snowy mountains, and a warm community in the land of our ancestors?" The group Uri Tzafon also deployed balloons into southern Lebanon, ordering residents to leave what it called the Jew-owned land. Many ultra-Orthodox and other Israelis believe the borders of Israel should stretch into Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia as well. That's on top of the entirety of the occupied Palestine territories. This idea is called Greater Israel. You can learn more about it on MEE's YouTube film, The Origins of Greater Israel. As an analysis of Israeli military strategy, Greater Israel was once dismissed as a conspiracy theory, but now it is openly endorsed by leading Israeli politicians. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has pledged destruction in Lebanon on a level seen in Gaza. Opposition leader Yair Lapid spoke of sweeping depopulation.
אני חושב שבסוף לא יהיה לנו מנוס אלא לנסות ליצור בדרום לבנון איזה סוג של אזור סטרילי, לא ענק, אבל משהו בדומה קצת לקו הצהוב בעזה. זאת אומרת, אזור שאין בו כפרים לבנונים, אלא הוא שטח נקי לגמרי בין הלבנוני האחרון ליישוב הישראלי הראשון.
What lies in store for Lebanon? Are the lessons in history and will they ever be learned? I'm joined now by Israeli journalist and author Gideon Levy. Gideon, welcome to MEE Live. How relevant is this concept of Greater Israel among Israeli political decision-making? Is this invasion into Lebanon about self-defense, or is it fair to say there could be more sinister ambitions?
Neither nor. I don't think that the idea of Greater Israel is a practical idea. It is in the mind of some lunatics, but I wouldn't take it too seriously, because we have alternative ideas which are not less crazy and destructive, and they are deep rooted. For example, the fact that for the sake of some notion of security for Israel, Israel has the right to do whatever it wants. For example, the notion that for the sake of Israel's security, the only answer is more invasions, more bombardments, more attacks, more destructions, more killings. This will solve the problem of the security of Israel. Those are very deep-rooted ideas. Also, the idea that for Israel, the international law doesn't count at all, is irrelevant. And the fact that Israel can almost do whatever it wants with the backing of the United States enable, and now I'm speaking in general terms, not only about Lebanon. This is the mindset. And within this framework, we can speak about Lebanon, but I think the idea to conquer Lebanon for the sake of making Israel great, no. They might conquer Lebanon for the sake of having again this security zone or security belt like we had for years, which didn't solve anything. This, yes, to make Israel greater in the term that another strip until the Litani will not be populated, but that's not the dream of Greater Israel.
I mean, we've seen invasions of southern Lebanon like this before. In the past, it has led to more violent resistance, including the formation of Hezbollah itself. Is this a strategy that will keep Israelis safe?
No, definitely not. It is a strategy which will keep Israel under attacks again and again. I must remind you that Hezbollah came to the world after the occupation of South Lebanon and parts of Lebanon. This was, I don't want to say that only this, but it happened under the Israeli occupation. This was the reaction to the occupation. And any more occupation will create more resistance, and this mindset will not lead us to any good places, as it didn't until now.
In that case, whose interests is this invasion in? Who is this serving?
So let's put things in order. Hezbollah joined Iran. It was warned by Israel not to do so. I can't blame Israel for opening the fire with Hezbollah, because Hezbollah opened the fire. Israel immediately reacted massively, because Israel believes now only in military steps and military actions. And according to this doctrine, any violation or any rocket launching into Israel might bring a huge operation, including a territorial invasion. And here we are.
Do you think that this would have been part of Netanyahu's plan when he launched the initial attacks on Iran? Is it feasible that actually the intention or could have always been there to invade Lebanon as part of that war?
No, I don't think he needs Iran for invading Lebanon, because Lebanon was on certain low fire ever since the ceasefire, which Israel never respected. Israel continued to attack South Lebanon, didn't stop even for one single day ever the ceasefire was signed. So it's not like he needed Iran for this. It is an outcome, quite expected outcome to the attack over Iran, but I wouldn't say that he went to bomb Iran in order to be able to bomb Lebanon. He can do it without Iran.
Today we've seen France, Germany, Italy, the UK and Canada urge Israel not to launch its ground invasion. That was actually Monday, not today. They've warned that this will have huge devastating humanitarian consequences. Will Israel listen to these urgences?
Obviously not. I guess you know the answer. For Israel, the world contains only one state now, and this is the United States of America. All the rest is irrelevant for Israel's considerations. You see it, you saw it in Gaza, you see it now in Lebanon. Israel learned to ignore, and in many ways, rightly so, because all those countries that you mentioned and others never took measures against Israel. Israel is not listening to them and doesn't pay any price for this. So why would Israel listen to them?
Gideon Levy, thank you so much for your time, for your expertise. And I hope it's okay to say, as a journalist, it's a real privilege to interview you. I've been a huge admirer of your work for a long time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All the best. Bye.
Likewise. Now, for today, that is all that we have time for on MEE Live. But before we lose you, we would love to hear from you. Please send in your thoughts and questions to @MiddleEastEye on any social platform or email meelive@middleeasteye.net. We'll be here at 5 p.m. GMT, noon in New York, every Tuesday and Thursday. See you then.
What you just heard was a podcast from Middle East Eye. More information about Middle East Eye is at www.middleeasteye.net. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Sumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert on Middle East politics, published an opinion on Middle East Eye titled, "By Serving Israel's Agenda, Trump Betrayed Gulf Allies." Ghannouchi argues that instead of shielding the region from conflict, the presence of American bases, which were supposed to protect Gulf states, has turned them into targets in a war they neither started nor wanted. She says, quote, "From Doha to Riyadh, the lesson is becoming difficult to ignore. The arrangement meant to guarantee their security is now exposing them to danger," unquote. Let's listen to her opinion.
Benjamin Netanyahu has done something many in Washington once swore would never happen again. He has dragged the US back into a Middle Eastern war. The last time this happened was in 2003, the invasion of Iraq. That war was supposed to reshape the region. Its architects in Washington, men like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, believed they were launching what they proudly called the new American century. Baghdad fell within days and Washington declared victory, but the victory didn't last. What followed was insurgency, chaos, and 20 years of war. For a time, a broad consensus emerged in Washington. The invasion of Iraq had been a catastrophic error, one that must never be repeated. Yet today, the US finds itself drawn back into the very labyrinth Trump once promised to avoid, and the man who led it there is Benjamin Netanyahu. Since Trump returned to power, Netanyahu has worked relentlessly to steer American policy toward confrontation with Iran. The pressure campaign was constant, repeated visits, relentless lobbying, and influence channeled through figures close to Trump's inner circle, most notably his son-in-law Jared Kushner. The message was simple: strike Iran, reshape the Middle East, remove Israel's most powerful adversary. Eventually, the decision was made. Trump authorized military operations against Iran and launched a campaign targeting senior figures in its leadership. But it's already becoming clear that this war will not be quick, and it will certainly not be easy. There will be no Venezuelan scenario here. The war was not triggered by an imminent Iranian attack on American territory. Iran does not possess strategic weapons capable of threatening the US itself, and its nuclear program had already been constrained under the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and the world's major powers. That deal imposed strict limits on uranium enrichment and subjected Iran to international monitoring. Iran complied until the US withdrew from the agreement during Trump's first administration. In later negotiations, Tehran even indicated it was willing to reduce enrichment to bare minimum. And only months ago, Trump himself claimed Iran's nuclear capabilities had been obliterated, which raises a simple question. If they were obliterated, why is there a war now to obliterate them, to eliminate Iran's nuclear capabilities? For decades, Israel fought its wars while the US provided weapons, intelligence, and diplomatic backing. But formally, those wars were Israel's. The distinction mattered, even during the Gulf War in the early 1990s, when Saddam Hussein fired Scud missiles at Israel, Washington refused to allow Israel to enter the coalition. Why? Because American leaders wanted Arab states to remain part of the alliance. Israel and the US, of course, coordinated very closely behind the scenes, but the war remained America's war, not a joint one. Today, that line has disappeared. For the first time, Washington and Tel Aviv are fighting the same war openly, side by side. The consequences are already rippling across the Gulf. For decades, the Gulf monarchies built their security strategy around a simple bargain: oil and money in exchange for security. For 60 years, this was the stable equation. Gulf states invested enormous wealth in the American economy. They hosted American bases, and in return, Washington guaranteed stability. But Trump has shattered that equation. He wants the money, he wants the oil, but he's no longer providing the security. In fact, he's now threatening the security of the very states that finance the alliance. During Trump's 2025 Gulf tour, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar pledged gigantic investment commitments worth around $3 trillion over time. Gulf money flowed into American projects, some of it even into ventures linked directly to Trump and his family. Entities tied to the UAE's national security leadership reportedly purchased a 49% stake in the Trump-linked cryptocurrency venture World Liberty Financial in a deal worth around $500 million. Meanwhile, Jared Kushner's investment firm, Affinity Partners, manages billions from Gulf sovereign wealth funds, including a $2 billion commitment from Saudi Arabia. These are not random transactions, they're calculated strategic decisions. One may agree with them or disagree with them, but they form part of a deal, even if it's an unequal one. And Trump has now broken the terms of that deal, because when war arrived at the Gulf's doorstep, the region was not even consulted. Trump has carried out what many in the region see as a double betrayal. First, he launched his war behind the backs of the Gulf states, without consultation, without warning. He dragged their region into a war they did not want. Then he went further still. He began pressing them to become fodder for the war itself. There's a bitter irony here, because the very American bases meant to guarantee Gulf security now place those countries directly in the line of fire. These are not symbolic facilities. They're vast military installations housing thousands of troops, aircraft, command centers, and missile systems. And because they exist, Gulf states automatically become targets whenever the US enters a war. In other words, the protector becomes the danger. Instead of shielding the region from conflict, American bases turned the Gulf into the battlefield. A Kuwaiti political analyst recently captured this irony perfectly. He says, "People think the Americans are defending us, but today we are the ones defending the Americans." That unease is no longer being expressed only behind closed doors. It has begun to surface publicly. The Emirati businessman Khalaf Al-Habtour, close to the Abu Dhabi Palace, addressed Donald Trump directly with a question that many in the Gulf are now quietly asking. Who gave you the authority to drag our region into a war with Iran? Did you calculate the collateral damage before pulling the trigger? Those questions capture a growing frustration across the region, because Washington did not merely launch a war, it launched it in someone else's neighborhood. And Washington is now going further still. It's pressing Gulf states to join the war itself. Senator Lindsey Graham, who seems to spend more time in Tel Aviv than he does in South Carolina, has been running around urging Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states to enter the conflict. This is the same Lindsey Graham who, as the Wall Street Journal reports, has been busy coaching Netanyahu on how to bend Donald Trump to his wishes on Iran. Now he's touring the region with a mixture of threats and sweet promises. The US gave you weapons, use them, as though those weapons were generous, free gifts not paid for with tens of billions of dollars. If you fight Iran, we will protect you, we will sign a security agreement with you. But really, so what exactly were all those American bases for? And the billions spent on US military installations across their territory? I thought that was the security agreement, you know, the one that was supposed to guarantee their protection. And recent events have only deepened suspicions across the region. Israeli media circulated claims that the UAE had attacked an Iranian desalination facility. The report was quickly and firmly denied by UAE officials, but the danger was obvious. Such an attack could easily have triggered Iranian retaliation against desalination plants across the Gulf, facilities that provide the vast majority of drinking water in countries like the UAE. For many in the region, the episode looked like a calculated attempt to trick the Gulf into war, which raises a deeper question. Who benefits from chaos in the Middle East? Not the Gulf states, not the Arab world, but there is one country whose strategic thinking has long emphasized a different logic: Israel. For decades, Israeli strategists have argued that when surrounding states weaken, fragment, or collapse, Israel's relative power increases. Chaos for others can become strategic advantage for Israel. Recently, Israeli writer Ma'e Swissa published an article entitled Sykes-Picot 2026, Time to Redraw the Middle East Map. Arab and Islamic states that present themselves as national states modeled on the West may lose their importance to a model in which the tribe and clan once again become the real units of governance. He wrote, "The inevitable end is already appearing on the horizon." This new chaotic order would not be drawn by diplomats with rulers and fountain pens, he says, but by wars that dismantle existing states and rebuild them from the ruins. Lebanon and Syria, the writer suggested, would be the first laboratories. Well, that vision may strengthen Israel, but it doesn't strengthen the US. For decades, American power in the Middle East rested on stability, on alliances, on the security architecture built around the Gulf. The Gulf is not a marginal theater of American policy. It's one of the pillars of American global influence, central to global energy markets, home to major US military bases, and a major source of investment in the American economy. Now that architecture is being shaken by Trump, and of course, China and Russia are watching closely, for them, America's renewed entanglement in the Middle East is an opportunity. The deeper Washington sinks into Middle Eastern wars, the more room its rivals gain. And so a strategic paradox is emerging. In trying to serve Israel's agenda, the US may be undermining its own position in the very region that sustains its global influence. For the Gulf states, the lesson is becoming difficult to ignore. The security arrangement meant to protect them may now be exposing them to danger. And in Washington, the central question may soon no longer be about Iran, it will be about Israel, whether implementing its strategy is protecting American interests or quietly eroding them.
That was Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, with an opinion published on Middle East Eye. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.